The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Welcome to the future you. Frank Lloyd Wright once said, "Study nature, love nature, stay close to nature, and it will never fail you." At Zija, we love nature. We study nature. In India, we discovered Moringa and created Moringa Supermix, a revolutionary new combination of organic ingredients, including natural vitamins, minerals, proteins, antioxidants, and omega oils. Zija's new Moringa Supermix will help you make a change for the better. Simply click on the Zija banner on the UKHealthRadio.com homepage. Power people need power vitality.
Dr. Brian Halverson is one of the UK's leading holistic dentists. He is the author of Great Teeth for Life and lectures widely to the public and to health practitioners. Brian is passionate about providing preventative information that will guide us through all the stages of our lifetime. And now, here is Dr. Brian Halverson, the integrated dentist. I can see
clearly now. Hi, Brian here. Welcome to the Integrated Dentist. This will be my first show on UK Health Radio. I hope you'll enjoy the ride. My first subject today will be sugar. Very much in the news at the moment with sugar tax, various notables, including doctors, talking about the ill effects of sugar on our general health. I'd like to go back a little bit and look at certain ignored facts, and I will say facts. If we take the situation during the war, when we had very, very little access to sugar, new cases of diabetes dropped by 1,000%, and they only started increasing when sugar was taken off of rationing. So, is there a link? Well, the inverted commas authorities tell us not, but to me it's highly suspicious. Now, the reason I'm saying this is because then we go to the early 70s and you have Professor Yudkin, who wrote Pure, White and Deadly, talking about refined sugars. He was most concerned because he regarded sugar as being just that, deadly, but mainly not from the point of view of tooth decay, although of course that was mentioned, but much, much more from the relationship to heart disease and diabetes and all the other things which we now know is irrefutably shown to be caused by the overconsumption of sugar. Now, when I was actually a student, we were told that sugar has got a relationship between tooth decay. And they said, well, it's not really what type of sugar it is, it's actually about the frequency. Now, it is absolutely true that if we're talking about tooth decay and gum disease and its relationship to sugar, it isn't about the quantity, it's about the frequency. If I give you just a simple illustration, if you were to suck on some sugar containing, call it Polos or whatever, I don't want to victimize them particularly, if you were to suck on those all day, the chances of getting holes in your teeth are very, very considerable. However, if you were to get that same packet and chew them up and swallow them in one go, sure, it won't do your diabetes any good, your heart disease or anything else, but if we're totally being selfish about what effect will it have on your likelihood and risk of getting tooth decay, it will be less. So it's not about the quantity, it's about the frequency. Now, this applies to most things that actually cause problems in the mouth. And an aside, but similar, is the fact that if we're having not just sugar-containing drinks, but drinks that also have acids in them, and this could be anything from fruit juice, the usual colas, but even carbonated water, the acids, no matter how strong it is, if it's frequently applied to the mouth, it literally will dissolve away the surface of your teeth. And often when I'm seeing patients who complain about tooth sensitivity, it's often traced back to having frequent interludes between having not just sugary, but also acidic drinks or foods. So it's just a quick tip that if you find you're getting sensitivity or your dentist says to you, your teeth looks to me as if they're dissolving away, i.e. they're getting thinner, the enamel's getting thinner on the surface, then this is normally the primary cause. And again, it's about our diet and the quality of the food products and drinks that we're having. This is something that from a holistic point of view, I will keep coming back to. Why? Is because if we're looking at our general health related to our dental health, there is a direct relationship. In fact, a lot of late medical research has shown that 80% of our disease that occurs in the body originates in the mouth. I found this hard to comprehend, but in my researches, I fully now comprehend why the mouth is so important. And over the programs, I'd like to basically always bring us back to this, that you can't detach the mouth from the rest of the body. But also, what's going in the body will also be shown in the mouth. But if we take away sugar, then we'll also find that everything in the terms of the functionality of our body, and the main thing that we need to consider is what is now generally termed the microbiome, the microbes that live on and in us. We have always thought that the microbiome or the microbes, bacteria, are always against us. We now realize that we cannot survive without them. And what sugar will do, as a good example, is encourage the baddies or the pathogenic bacteria to multiply, and in the detriment of the beneficial bacteria. And in the mouth, this will cause the growth or the overgrowth of especially bacteria, which in fact tend to grow on the sugar, produce acids, and then produce holes in your teeth. So it's much more about the fact we have to go right the way back to the what I'll call the basics of how our body functions. Most of us now know, certainly in the medical area, is that we are composed of approximately 10 trillion cells. That's 10 and 12 noughts. However, living on and in us is 100 times 10 the number of microbes. Now, microbes are bacteria, viruses, yeasts, but they communicate directly with every part of our body. For example, if we look at the mood enhancers, things called serotonin and dopamine, the things that make us feel good, 70% is actually produced by our microbiome in the gut. So we cannot live without the microbiome that lives in us. The mouth is where these things originate from. I think although I may be labouring the point, it is so important because if we look at things like sugar, other chemicals and that which alter the microbiome, it's having a more profound effect right the way through our body. For example, when we're swallowing, every 4 hours, we're actually swallowing 20 billion microbes, which then goes into the gut and has an effect, which then can have an effect on the brain and everything else. So getting back to our good old friend sugar, although there are obviously many, many other negative influences, the overconsumption of sugar, especially refined sugar, has a profound effect. I would like to spend some time discussing our children's dental health. Now, unfortunately, there is a social divide. And in the lower socioeconomic groups, we do find that there is more tooth decay, especially in the under sixes. Is this a UK problem? No. The same is found in the USA and Australia. And the figures, which I will quote, are absolutely horrendous, are true for all these so-called civilized countries. The common thing they have is similar diet and lifestyle. Now, a massive survey in 2007 looked at children's dental health in the age group of 6 and under. Most of these children would not have even been attending the dentist. Now, in the UK, we can subdivide it into England, and here, in the under 60s, remember, 38% of children under 6 had some form of decay or disease in their teeth. In Scotland, this figure was 46%, and in Wales, it was 52%. Now, if you think about it, this is children who have got problems, decay, damage to their teeth, which, if it's not looked at from a preventative point of view, is going to lead them to a lifetime of problems. Everything from extractions, and we've seen from the documentary film about Manchester Hospital, where most of the general anaesthetic times was taken up with extracting multiple extractions of children's teeth. Now, horrendous scenes and distress, but all preventable. So we do have to take some form of action on sugar. And I do reiterate, the primary cause of tooth decay, especially in the younger generation. It's no good regarding sweets as a form of reward, because this only creates the image of, if you're good, we'll give you a sweet. And this will go on for a lifetime, that, oh well, a little bit of sugar isn't a problem. Well, even just from the dental point of view, not taking a holistic point of view, we see that this can lead to a lifetime of problems. A lot of it, as we get older, also can be avoidable financial problems in the amount of dental treatment we need. And my philosophy is, let's look at education and prevention. Now, if we look at that, what tips and advice can we give, especially to our younger generation? Parents are fully responsible for the health and welfare of their children's teeth. And this literally starts at before conception. So that if we have an education system where our children can be looked at as a prevention measure before they're even conceived, so that our potential parents are given advice on improving their own health, and consequently then passing that information on to the children. We cannot make people forcibly prevent having the sort of diet and lifestyle that they have possibly been socially conditioned into, but we can provide them with effective education. And I believe sugar is a very, very good starting point, because it is literally pure white and deadly, but it's black and white that we know this has health consequences in the mouth and the rest of the body. And I may keep reiterating this because it is such an important area to get over. The other thing that we really have to realize is that sugar is more addictive than cocaine. So this is not a small order to get people to change their habits, but it's one area that I believe certainly not only the dental profession, but the medical profession can provide huge amounts of support for people to actually change their dietary habits. Can we look at the food industry? The answer is that yes, we can put legislation there and we can ask them to persuade. But just like with the ill effects of smoking, it has to be out there in very, very clear terms. If we can just get this one area where we can just even reduce the consumption of refined sugars, we'll see not just a benefit in terms of the health and welfare of our next generation, but also the massive cost saving for, in this country, for example, the health service. So it's a win-win if we can just get the effective education across to our younger generation, which also means next generation to have children. I will keep coming back to this issue, including other issues associated with diet, but hopefully we can start a new revolution in terms of not saying, oh, well, a little bit of sugar here, a little bit of sugar there. But the fact is that we all know that most foods contain sugar. Bread, tomato sauce, baked beans. There isn't hardly any of our food that's not contaminated. So we all have to make an effort to try to make a difference. Now, my next subject matter is in fact an interview with Nigel Carter, OBE. Nigel is head and has been for many years of the Oral Health Foundation. So let's listen to Nigel. It is my great pleasure to introduce Nigel Carter, OBE, CEO of the Oral Health Foundation. Nigel, can you tell me how it all started for you?
Well, it started many years ago. The Oral Health Foundation is the new name for an organisation that's now been going for 45 years, previously known as the British Dental Health Foundation. And shortly after qualifying as a dentist, I got taken along by my then principal in the practice that I was working in to a Midlands branch committee meeting of the foundation, which was actually discussing a smile event, the first smile event of its sort, which was done in conjunction with the Birmingham Evening Mail, a nice smiles competition with prizes awarded by the Lord Mayor of Birmingham. And we got the whole of the front page of the Birmingham Evening Mail, which really was a great success for promoting oral health and the value of a smile in those days. Because most of the news around dentistry was doom and gloom and negative. And that was always something that the British Dental Health Foundation was set up to counteract, with people having lost through the 50s and 60s lots of teeth. We wanted to get out there and get the message across to people that teeth could be for life. So that was my first experience, and I have to say that this year, from those small beginnings in Birmingham, we've celebrated the 40th anniversary of National Smile Month, which is probably now one of the largest oral health promotion campaigns, annual campaigns worldwide.
Nigel, that's fascinating. And, you know, I really applaud you for your dedication over many, many years. May I ask, where would you like to see things going for your organisation, and where do you think we could improve the sort of health of the nation? Because in my latest book, we're still looking at appalling figures for tooth decay, especially in the under sixes.
Well, that's very true. I mean, things have improved enormously. The trigger for the foundation being formed all those years ago was the first adult dental health survey, and the shocking fact was that 38%, so over a third of the adult population, so that's the population over the age of 16, had no teeth at all, which really is quite appalling.
I know. I mean, really, you just cannot conceive that, you know, even to the point of just how many teeth had to be extracted.
Absolutely. And I mean, this goes back to the early years of the health service. And of course, 38% over the age of 16 meant that by the time you got to 45, 50, more than half of people had lost all their teeth. A little bit older than that, you were probably looking at 75%, 80%. And of course, once they're gone, they're gone. So if in 1970 we were looking at people in their 30s that had lost their teeth, for the figures to improve, we've actually had to wait for that cohort of people to gradually get older and die. But I'm pleased to say that that figure is now down to around 6%. So one of our jobs is done in terms of the fact that people expect their teeth to be there for life. And I'd love to say it was entirely due to our activities, but it also has an awful lot to do with fluoride coming into toothpaste in the 1970s. And that measure alone was responsible for reducing decay experience in the UK by probably 40 to 50%. But we do still have this worrying proportion of children experiencing decay, around a third of children going to school with experience of decay. And we have to remember that this is a totally preventable disease. It's all down to how we look after our teeth at home, visiting the dentist regularly, and the amount of sugary foods and drinks in our diet. And I mean, it really is quite appalling, the high number of cases of child general anaesthetics. It's the most common reason for children being admitted to hospital is to have a general anaesthetic, is for tooth extractions. And really, we do need to do something about that and change it. As much as anything else, it's, you know, it's not a pleasant introduction to children into dentistry, and it's also costing the NHS a fortune.
Yes, I totally agree. And I think you would agree with me that you cannot force anybody to change their diet or lifestyle, but you can provide relevant educational material.
That's certainly what we've been trying to do at the foundation over the last 45 years. I mean, we have a very comprehensive range of patient education leaflets, which are largely distributed through dentists. There are around 53 titles in our Tell Me About series. They're all written in plain English. They're easy to access. And they form the core material also that is on our website. And the website gets between 3.5 and 4 million unique visitors a year. So hopefully we are having quite a good reach through that. But it does seem that there's something very strange about oral health, that people recognise the messages, they know what they should be doing to look after their teeth, they simply don't do it. And I think part of the reason behind that is this history that we've just been talking about of tooth loss. It's only in the parents and grandparents generation of the mothers and parents of children today that the expectation was that teeth would be lost, as we now know, you know, unnecessarily with modern techniques. But therefore, we have people who were being taught how to clean their teeth and look after their teeth and taught their oral hygiene habits by people who probably lost their own teeth. And they're then imparting this to their children. So the messages get mixed. And this is where the dental profession, the dental team, the dentists, hygienists, therapists and dental nurses come in and have such a valuable role in terms of helping people to clean their teeth properly. And that's very important to start at a young age, because we do find that the habits that are instilled when people are young last for life. Most dentists would recommend people to clean their teeth for 2 minutes at a time, twice a day, last thing at night, and on at least one other occasion. But what we see from numerous studies is that the average length of time that people are brushing their teeth for is only 45 seconds. And that's established in the early years, before age 7. And we would always recommend to patients, supervise your children brushing their teeth up to age 7, because those habits are going to be there for a lifetime.
Nigel, would you agree that because statistically only about 50% of the public actually attend regularly to the dentist, that we should be trying to, what should we say, provide the sort of valuable information that you can do through your Oral Health Foundation to, say, schools or other media outlets, which would make the educational process not just confined to those who almost sort of say, well, I ought to go to the dentist, and therefore, you know, we're dealing with a group that already are moving towards better oral health. My concern is the sort of large numbers that possibly aren't even getting any messages.
I think that's absolutely true, and there's a great deal of difference between need and demand. A lot of the people who really need to be visiting the dentist regularly, quite often from lower socioeconomic groups, have other priorities on their mind, and dentistry and good oral health is not at the top of them. And yet, for various factors, from poor diet through to higher smoking levels, which also affects their oral health and their gum health, and financial pressures of the cost of attending the dentist, they're less likely to attend. And many of these people are the people with the highest need. So yes, outreach is essential. It's encouraging that as the government discusses bringing in a new contract for NHS dentists, for the first time in 70 years of the health service, we are going to be looking at some payments for preventive services and for improving the health of patients within the practice. But that still doesn't get across to the group that we're talking about here, aren't attending the dentist on a regular basis. So a combination of using the dental workforce to get out of their surgeries, into schools, into the workplace, into colleges and universities, to get some of those basic messages across is essential. And we're also in a problem now where quite a lot of people have got very little experience of decay. And we've been talking about the worrying proportion of children going to school, around a third going to school with experience of decay. But for a lot of people, they're not doing what happened in the 1960s and 70s and having a series of fillings as children. So that can lead to a sense of complacency. And those people are equally at risk of developing problems later on. So we do have to get messages out there to the whole of the population.
Yes. Interestingly enough, on my researches, we are not a lot different in terms of our tooth decay rates to those in either the USA or Australia.
No, I mean that we're not actually bad in terms of the world and even the European league tables. I do a lot of work with the Platform for Better Oral Health in Europe, and statistics are notoriously bad in a number of the countries. But I mean, when we look at some of the countries, particularly in Eastern Europe, ratio of dentists to the population and the general standard of oral health is much worse than the UK. So we shouldn't be all doom and gloom, but we always have to remember whatever percentage is there that this is totally preventable and we can get away from it. It's good to see sugar consumption coming into the spotlight, but it's almost as though oral health and dental decay is an afterthought. The main reason for the government looking at things like the sugar tax and there being a lot of media coverage of sugar is around obesity leading to heart disease and diabetes and not necessarily to dental decay. And worldwide, one of the shocking facts which comes out of World Health Organization studies is dental decay is the number one non-communicable disease worldwide.
Really? Gosh, yes. I mean, I know that if you take all forms of gum disease, you're virtually looking at the whole population being of the world being affected in one way or another. But in terms of identifiable disease, I didn't know that tooth decay had such a high profile or, you know, what should we say, incidence in the global population.
Yeah, I mean, it's grouped in with what they call the non-communicable diseases, which are the things that are not passed on by viral infections or bacterial infections. So this is things like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and so on. And actually, worldwide, yeah, dental decay does come out as number one. But so often when we look at the preventive measures, the role of oral health and dental decay is neglected and measures are brought in for other things. It's almost as though the teeth don't matter, but of course they do. And one of the interesting things and probably one of the most active areas of research at the moment is in the connections between oral health, the health of the mouth, particularly the health of the gums, as you were referring to, and diseases elsewhere in the body. We've always known that people with diabetes are more prone to get gum disease, but it's recently been proven that people with gum disease are more likely to get diabetes. Equally, there are connections with cardiovascular disease. There are connections with poor outcomes in pregnancy, preterm babies, low birth weight babies as a result of gum disease. And even through to dementia, we're seeing greater progress of dementia in patients who have fewer teeth. So there's clearly some connection there and lots of research being done at the moment on these connections.
Yes, I must admit, it is a particular area I'm looking at, and it seems to be very much related to literally the microbes that live in our body.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, a lot of the periodontal researchers, the gum health researchers, are desperately trying to find what the connections are. There's a lot of evidence that the connections are there, but we don't quite know how they work at the moment. And I think that's going to be still take a number of years to really work out exactly how these connections work. Is it just a group of patients that we've got that are more prone to sort of infectious type diseases? So that's why they're more prone to gum disease, to cardiovascular disease and so on. Or is it actually the bacteria from the gums that are getting into the system and causing the problems? And that's where a lot of the research is focused.
Yes, and I think this is an area where there's a lot of excitement because if we're looking at what I'll call the ecology of the bacteria, viruses, yeast in the mouth, and we're seeing this sort of unfortunate bacterial resistance to antibiotics, I think we have to start looking at ways of improving the what I'll call the bacterial microbe ecology, because what affects the mouth affects the gut, and what affects the gut then affects the brain. So, you know, the mouth and a lot of very well-known, prominent health scientists have actually said that 80% of diseases originate in the mouth. So we are really very, very high priority to sort out, you know, the links, as you rightly say.
Absolutely. I mean, this really is key. And I mean, one of the phrases that we used, dentistry in the way that it was set up in the UK within the health service in 1946, very much sat alongside medicine, not integrated with medicine. And one of the things that we've got to do today, and one of the phrases that we use, is we've got to put the mouth back into the body. We can't just look at teeth and gums and not recognise the effect that they have on the whole body.
Now, I think, to be honest, if the name of my show is actually The Integrated Dentist, and it is about integrating knowledge that we have with other health practitioners and professionals, so that, in fact, we can all share into bringing the well-being of the individual, in effect. But I think we play a far more important role than we ever thought of when we first qualified.
Absolutely. I would totally agree with you there, Brian. And of course, going back to the outreach out into the community and the hard-to-reach groups that aren't visiting the dentist, that's where we need to be working with other healthcare professionals, from health visitors through to social workers, elderly care workers, to ensure that oral health is integrated into all their programs. And perhaps the recent move of control for public health, including oral health, to local authorities will help with this, because clearly there are advantages to the local authorities in terms of reduced cost if they can get their population to have a better oral health.
Absolutely. Now, Nigel, it's been absolutely my pleasure listening to you. Could you tell the listeners where they can get hold of you in terms of your contact details, your website?
Absolutely. You can visit us on the website at dentalhealth.org. Our two major campaigns are National Smile Month, which is in May every year, and that's at smilemonth.org. And then we also have Mouth Cancer Action Month at mouthcancer.org. So three websites that you can go to there for a wealth of information.
Oh, that's fantastic, because, you know, I know you've been doing this and you had the vocation to actually see the improvement in the nation's health. And, you know, I applaud you and your team for what you're doing. So thank you very much again, Nigel.
It's been a pleasure, Ryan.
Thank you, Nigel. And for the rest of the show, I shall be talking about vitamin C. I first became acquainted with vitamin C was many, many years ago, when I first started my practice. A patient came to me saying that she suffering from terrible mouth ulcers. And when I looked at her mouth, the whole of her lining, her cheeks, her palate, her tongue, was covered in ulcers. She'd been to the doctors and they'd given her some steroids to take, which really didn't seem to have any improvement. She asked me, have I got any solutions? And I said, well, look, I'll tell you what, I'll do a bit of research and see if I can come up with something. So I did a bit of reading, and this was really before I had a huge interest in holistic dentistry. And the literature said that sometimes large doses of vitamin C can reduce ulceration. So Julie, I said to her, look, you know, if you take this vitamin C, it's not going to particularly harm you and it may work. So I suggested taking about 1 gram a day, which is about 1,000 milligrams. In those days, I thought this was quite a high dose. So the lady took this for a couple of weeks, came back and said, well, literally within a week of taking it, the ulcers had disappeared. My concern was that, you know, was this a large dose? And could be she had side effects if she kept this large dose going. Now, remember, this is well over 30 years ago. So I said, look, cut the amount down. So she reduced it to 500 milligrams per day. And she said immediately the ulcers recurred. So she instinctively upped the dose to a gram. The ulcers disappeared. Now, I was absolutely, totally knocked out by this particular result on this one patient, but that wouldn't be a scientific study. But however, I did start to look and do research into vitamin C. One of the first things I discovered was the fact that in the days of sailing ships, when sailors went to sea, often forced to, they had very little access to fresh fruit and vegetables. And they developed a condition called scurvy, which was severe lack of vitamin C. Enough so it caused disease symptoms. The main symptom was in fact bleeding swollen gums. I thought, aha, could this be a relationship, especially with patients who suffered from bleeding swollen gums, especially when they were doing most things right, i.e. they were seeing the hygienist regularly, they were brushing their teeth as they were told, there wasn't a great deal of plaque on their teeth and gums, and yet they were still suffering from vitamin C. So often I would suggest to these patients, you know, take a dose, possibly 1 gram or more, and see if it improved. In many, many cases, it did work. And so my view on vitamin C is simply the fact that it certainly does improve the health of the gums. And in fact, I always say as a first port of call that if you have recurrent mouth ulcers, try vitamin C. Now, vitamin C, or ascorbic acid, is one of the few vitamins that you cannot actually produce and store in your body. So we do need regular top-ups or an amount which will keep us in relatively good health. Now, the RDA, or how much you should have per day, is at 75 milligrams. In my estimation, this is far too low. It's the equivalent of possibly one fresh orange. Now, I think in an ideal world where we didn't suffer from stress, nutritional deficiencies, toxins, and bear in mind that vitamin C is a great detoxer and what we call chelating agent. I believe we need far more than 75 milligrams. In fact, for most people, I think you need to take about 1 gram. Now, should this come from natural sources or should it come from, say, taking a vitamin C supplement? Surveys have been done where they've checked the excretion levels of vitamin C in urine so that they can estimate how much is actually in the body. And for a large majority of, inverted commas, regularly healthy people, it is below the optimum amount. So if ever I am asked, should people take vitamin C, I always say that although it may mean taking a supplement, to get the equivalent of, say, 1 gram, we'd be looking at, say, 40 fresh oranges. Now, a lot of people do not like taking supplements. And I would say that because we're all individual, there is no great need to think that I must have to take it. But possibly, as I mentioned before, if one of the symptoms are that your gums are not as healthy as they should be, even though you are following the route of, the say, your hygienist or what have you, then that may be one of the causes. Also, if you're suffering from regular mouth ulcers, again, it could be a lack of vitamin C. Because it has so much functions in about overall health, and you only need to look at Linus Pauling, who spent most of his working career investigating vitamin C and looking at his work relating to high doses of vitamin C and the prevention and treatment of cancer, that my view is that we should be looking at having certainly adequate amounts for all of us. It's inexpensive, but it does have to be of the right sort. Vitamin C, ascorbic acid, can be in two formats. One is an L-shaped molecule, which is an antioxidant, and because of that is exactly what we require. There is another format, which is a D-shaped molecule, which they say is almost antagonistic. It's a pro-oxidant and almost eliminates the effectiveness of the L shape, which is good for us. So how do we know the difference? Well, it depends on how it's manufactured, and it's not about the price. In the USA, if you look at a bottle of vitamin C, it will say L ascorbic acid. Now, in this country, often I've looked at bottles of vitamin C and they're not actually state that. But there you go for what you would regard as a reliable manufacturer. Taking vitamin C or any supplements is always a contentious issue. A lot of people don't like pill popping or what have you. And if there's any sort of, what should we say, uncertainty, and certainly looking at, say, vitamin C, discuss this with a good nutritionist and, if necessary, get the tests. Why do I make such a point about this? It's mainly because if we talk about, like most things in life, risk benefit, taking vitamin C in a supplemental form, I believe, has more benefits than it has risks. In fact, I really can't think of too many risks that you can get in terms of ill effects from taking vitamin C. And of course, it's widely available. You don't have to have a prescription for it. And most of it is relatively low cost. To me, it's what I will call a health insurance if you feel that you can take regular doses as a supplement for your health. Vitamin C is an acid. From a dentist's point of view, if you are taking vitamin C on a regular basis, then do remember that any acids can actually erode away your tooth surface. So if anything, like most acids, which can be anything from carbonated water to fruit juice, to, I'm afraid, things like colas, again, it's the acids, can erode away your teeth. Now, a tip is that if you have recently had an acidic drink of any nature, maybe good or bad for you, it's not the issue, but we're looking now at the topical effects on your teeth, then please do not actually brush your teeth after having, say, an acidic drink or some acidic fruit. In my own case, I've often noticed if I have, say, some grapes, when I run my tongue over the surface of my teeth, they feel actually slightly rough. And this is because the acids have literally started to dissolve away the surface. So the immediate inclination would be to actually brush your teeth to make the teeth feel nice and smooth again. However, the friction of the brush and the toothpaste will actually accelerate and take away the layer that has been, inverted commas, softened or dissolved away, therefore accelerating the loss of enamel on the tooth surface. Plan of action is to just possibly drink some water, plain water, and then leave your teeth for an hour so that your saliva can then remineralize the surface of the tooth. Then if you want to brush, fine, but your saliva acts as a terrific protective mechanism in the sense that it contains the salivary products such as calcium, phosphates, which will actually what we call remineralize the tooth surface. We'll be talking about the benefits of having good healthy saliva in a later show, but at this point it's just purely advice. If your teeth feel like they're rough because you've had something acidic, do not brush them immediately. Allow about an hour for the surface to literally be healed up by your saliva. Just to finish on, a little story about me as a six-year-old. I was born in London, and in those days, sugar was regarded as a treat. So my first experience of going to the dentist was to have four teeth out, my permanent molars, my first molars, which erupt at 6 years old. So they'd only just come through in the mouth and they'd already got decay. So my memory was that for some reason I turned up at this clinic and I did not really know if what was going to happen. So I went into the, call it the operating theatre, and in fact there was a chap there, the anaesthetist, who said, "Do you know what goes on when you send men into space?" Being a very bright kid, I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "When they're up there, there isn't any air." So I said, "Yes, I know." He said, "Well, tell you what, in this big mask I've got, it's what they use to keep the spacemen alive up in there, up in space, because there's no air up there, and this is the gas they use." He said, "Would you like to try it?" "Yes, please." So I grabbed the mask, put it over my face, out cold. Next thing I know, blood pouring out as these four big molar teeth have been extracted. But was I upset? Absolutely not. The point I'm making here is a lot of fear comes from the initial experiences you have, say, at the dentist or the doctor. And if you have a great experience, like I did, under the most traumatic circumstances, my view was never that I had that lasting scar. So it's just really often about the case that it's the singer, not the song. I was very lucky to have a superb anaesthetist who knew about child psychology. Here's hoping that all your visits to the dentist is at least psychologically as good as what I had as a six-year-old. As with my book, I wish you all great teeth for life. And I wish you happiness, health, and abundance. Thank you for listening.
I can see clearly.